What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is author Brooke Walensky Lanford, author of the new book, Paradise Lust, Searching for the Garden of Eden. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. For a couple of weeks now, the news from Israel has featured tent cities in the streets of Tel Aviv and huge protest demonstrations against economic injustice. What began in June as a Facebook-driven rebellion against the rising cost of cottage cheese in Israel, I am not making this up, morphed in July into tent encampments protesting soaring real estate costs, and in August has turned into a full-scale Israeli social movement against the high cost of living in the Jewish state. From Tel Aviv's tent-filled Rothschild Boulevard to marches in Beersheba, hundreds of thousands of Israelis have participated in one protest or another. The movement's targets have expanded from housing and cheese to everything from the cost of childcare and gas to salaries. So, just how expensive and difficult is it to live in Israel? Well, if you look at it, maybe not really that bad. A close examination shows that compared to the U.S. and Europe, Israeli costs of living are kind of a mixed bag. Salaries are lower, maybe half to a third of what we make here in America, but so is the cost of health care and a college education. Consumer goods and services are nearly double those in the United States, and owning a car can run six times as much relative to the salary, and food is indeed expensive. So, how do Israelis make it? Well, Israeli retailers and banks offer easy credit on everything from big-ticket items like summer vacations to everyday purchases like groceries. Everything can be paid in monthly installments. The result is that many Israelis are perennially in debt and increasingly frustrated by their inability to cover costs with their monthly paychecks. Now, the whole protest movement in Israel started, as our faithful listener Simon Rosenblatt reported a while back, with outrage over the steadily rising cost of cottage cheese, a kind of Israeli staple protein that has deep historical roots in early Zionism. In fact, all of this sound and fury began with an investigative report in a Business Daily that said that food prices for basic products are 2 to 3 times higher in Israeli stores than in other Western countries. For example, an 8-ounce container of that beloved cottage cheese costs $1.68, a pound of hummus about $4.50. 2 liters of orange juice in a country that exports oranges is $6.50. And Osem soup nuts cost $4.50 in Israel, more than they cost in American stores that import the soup nuts from Israel. When you get to the ridiculous end of it, a 6-ounce can of Israeli-made sunscreen can cost $40. Ouch. Prices have gone above what the middle class and other classes can afford, says Rami Levy, who has 22 supermarkets nationwide. Prices are rising, perhaps because Israeli supermarket chains are colluding to set prices. Well, maybe. But in a thriving economy with a fast growth rate and rising population, inflation is bound to occur. Anyway, the current protest movement is focused on housing, and costs there are very high in Israel. The most expensive and desirable places to live are in the center of the country, where the vast majority of the population resides and works. That means that in Jerusalem, in the popular Baca neighborhood or the German colony, a typical 2-bedroom apartment starts at over $425,000. That's a 2-bedroom apartment. In the peripheral outside ring neighborhoods of Jerusalem, some of which are built across the semi-mythical Green Line on territory captured from Jordan in the 67 Six-Day War, it is cheaper, but not that much. A 2-bedroom apartment there runs about $350,000. According to other realtors' figures, 2-bedroom apartments in Beersheba, Haifa, Hadera, and Afula cost between $140,000 and $280,000. Of course, you then have to live in Hadera or Afula or Beersheba. Now, Haifa is nice. Anyway, Tel Aviv real estate can be even more than Jerusalem. A two-bedroom apartment in a nice area starts at over $500,000. So housing is pricey and getting more expensive. You remember when that was true in America, don't you? Before housing prices began their seemingly inexorable decline. Anyway, there are areas where Israelis also have it pretty good. Education in Israel, for example, is much less expensive than the U.S. Tuition at Israel's renowned public universities, like the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, is $2,500, not a credit, a year. Fantastic bargain, thanks in large part to government subsidies. At Israel's lesser-known private colleges, tuition is still only about $8,000 a year, very inexpensive compared to American private college tuition, which can run more like $35,000 a year and more, and going up fast. In addition, all religious school education is covered by the state, and it's free. Medical costs in Israel are a fraction of what we pay. Israel's socialized healthcare system is considered the world's best, or one of them, and taxes pay the lion's share of costs. Healthcare costs deducted from an average paycheck are less than 5%. With a system of universal healthcare run by private corporations, we could really learn from them. All citizens get the same uniform medical package. Self-employed, employed by a company, whatever. Every citizen pays a health insurance rate to one of four HMOs, which are regulated by the government and subsidized. So for Israelis who have to go to the doctor or even need fertility treatments or visit the emergency room, the costs are minimal. Medications are cheaper in Israel than the U.S. They are also subsidized. Israelis can expand their coverage with private health insurance, but it also costs just a fraction of what it costs here. And the working poor are so much better off in Israel because if somebody gets sick, they still get full hospital treatment for what would be very expensive in the U.S. and probably unaffordable. Taxes in Israel are higher than here. Israel's more like Europe than the U.S. The top income tax rate is 45%. Israelis also pay a value-added tax, a VAT, which amounts to a national sales tax, their VAT, of 16%, much higher than our local and state sales taxes that might be 8 or 9% here. Well, so with all of that, the average Israeli pays income taxes of about 20%. The top 1% of salaried workers, who make like $250,000 a year, pay a 40% income tax rate. Not ridiculous, but high. Oddly, the top 1% of the Israeli self-employed, and this has come out a lot in the protests, the so-called super rich, who make an average of $1.5 million a year, pay just 26% in income tax, far less than the top salaried workers. I guess in every country, the really rich have a way around taxes. Remember as well that Israelis, especially Israeli men who are not ultra-Orthodox, also spend 3 years on active duty with the military, and then about a month a year for the next 20 doing miluim, reserve duty. That means they contribute a great deal to the state during their working lives, when we softer Americans are busy getting ahead in our careers. On balance, there are indeed issues in Israel of high prices and low salaries, but a great deal of the social net that has kept Israelis from dire poverty even when the country had far fewer resources and was in much bigger trouble is still intact. I tend to think that these protests will ultimately subside without any major change in the current system. The government will devote more of its resources to building housing and will figure out a way to lower the cost of cottage cheese by leaning on the food conglomerates. And eventually, although as Prime Minister Netanyahu said, we will not be able to please everybody. Imagine that, a country full of Jews and you can't please everybody, really? Well, things will settle back down. Because the difference between the protests in Israel now and the ones that are taking place in Syria or took place in Egypt or everywhere else in the Arab world is night and day, basically. It's the difference between peaceful demonstrations about the quality of life in places that have freedom of speech, that's Israel, and violent rebellion against fascist tyranny and terror, that's the Arab countries. Israel will remain, as it has always been, a model for how democratic, educated, committed citizens can resolve their differences peacefully for the good of all, and a demonstration of the vitality of a free country with free speech, a prominent feature of the whole society. To play us in, then, on Too Jewish, here's the famous Israeli band Hadag HaNachash, that means the snakefish. What that means, I actually don't know. And their unique song, made up entirely of phrases of free speech found on bumper stickers in Israel. It's called Shirat HaSticker. The words were written by author David Grossman, and the contrasting slogans that are the lyrics are still visible on bumper stickers all over Israel today.
שלום, תנו לצהל לנצח, עם חזק עושה שלום, תנו לצהל לכסח, אין שלום עם ערבים, אל תתנו להם רובים, קרי זה אחי, אחי, גיוס לכולם, תור לכולם,
אין שום ירוש בעולם,
יהיה, יש הזה כאן, הנחמן מאומן, no fear, משיח בעיר, אין ערבים, אין פיגועים, בקץ מסכן ילדים, העם עם הגולן, העם עם התוצר, אנחנו בוחרים לך
בחירה ישירה
ורב הקדוש ברוך הוא אנחנו קנאים לך
ימותו הקנאים
כמה רוע
כמה רוע רוע
אפשר לבלוע
אפשר לבלוע לוע
אבא תרחם אבא תרחם קוראים לי נחמן ואני מגם וגם גיים כמה רוע
כמה רוע רוע
אפשר לבלוע
אפשר לבלוע לוע
אבא תרחם אבא תרחם ברוך השם אני נושם ולחם הלכה המדינה משנולד הרגיח יחי המלך המשיח יש לי ביטחון בשלום של שרון חברון מאז ולתמיד ומי שלא נולד יציב חברון נבות שלום תצבר כאן הצדק
סיינן משקר
צריך מדי חזק
סיכון על השלום תודה על הביטחון
אין לנו ילדים למלחמות מיותרות השמאל עוזר לערבים וטוב לירדים פושעי אוסלו לדין אנחנו כאן הם שם אחים לא מבטירים עקירת יישובים מפלגת את העם מוות לבוגרים תנו לחיות לחיות
מוות לערכים
כמה רוע
כמה רוע רוע
אפשר לבלוע
אפשר לבלוע לוע
אבא תרחם אבא תרחם קוראים לי נחמן ואני מגם וגם גיים כמה רוע
כמה רוע רוע
אפשר לבלוע
אפשר לבלוע לוע
אבא תרחם אבא תרחם ברוך השם אני נושם נלחם כמה רוע
כמה רוע רוע
אפשר לבלוע
אפשר לבלוע לוע
אבא תרחם אבא תרחם קוראים לי נחמן ואני מגם וגם גיים כמה רוע
כמה רוע רוע
אפשר לבלוע
אפשר לבלוע לוע
That was Hadag HaNachash and their song Shirat HaSticker, the song of the bumper sticker. When we return in a few moments here on Two Jewish, we'll meet our guest, the author Brooke Walensky, who will tell us of the dangers and attractions of seeking the Garden of Eden. All that excitement right here on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, to find balance in life is to find happiness. Now, I assume he was a smart guy being a philosopher and all, so it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this, what one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese, heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce, crispy crust or lightly done crust. It's all in balance for each customer. And as Gerarducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through 8th grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register, arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit THAAZ.org. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Brooke Walensky-Lanford. She's the author of the new book, Paradise Lust, Searching for the Garden of Eden. You know, you tried to find a non-inflammatory title here, obviously.
You know, I admit I'm guilty of finding a title that I thought would spark some interest, but it's a little misleading.
Well done. We'll go on and talk about that and other things in a bit. She grew up in Mount Desert Island, Maine, as so many famous writers have, studied religion at Wesleyan, is a graduate of Columbia University's MFA program. She's written for the Huffington Post, Salon, Triple Canopy, Killing the Buddha, number of other online publications. She lives in the Garden State. That is New Jersey. Can one write about the Garden of Eden while living in Jersey, even if it is called the Garden State?
Well, if it can be done, I try.
Tell us where the idea for this book came from.
You know, it actually came from a family rumor. My dad told me that his uncle, my great uncle, who I'd never met, had been looking for the Garden of Eden in New York City in the 1950s. And I thought this was very strange because all I knew about this great uncle was that he was a scientist. He was an allergy professor and lived on the Upper East Side, and not, as far as I knew, a particularly religious person. So I thought, you know, how is it that he thinks that this is a place that can be found on Earth? And it turns out he was not the only one who thought that the Garden of Eden could be found on Earth, even in the modern era. So that's what sparked my interest, and it took me to a whole lot of places that I would not have expected.
Fascinating array of places that people have thought the garden could be found. My favorite story didn't even make it into the book. Maybe we'll talk about that later, but these places range from Ohio to Missouri to, well, you know, Iraq, which seems the most likely location. What was your weirdest place?
That is a tough call. I think that possibly the most surprising place would have to be the North Pole, which is actually the first chapter of the book. The first president of Boston University, who was a major guy, a Methodist theologian, wrote a 400-page book in 1881 trying to prove that the North Pole had once been warmer and had been home to giant, you know, species of plants and animals. And then after God flooded it, you know, it froze, and that's how we get the North Pole of today. That was a surprising story.
It's quite a story. With global warming, we may get back to that someday. In the book, you kind of explore, I mean, it's funny, it's kind of a picaresque story. It reminds me of some of the other people who've written in search of the Lost Ark or Mount Sinai, but you really have a kind of a puckish approach to it. I assume that was well respected by the people you talked to.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And as I said, this idea began for me with a story about my own family. So it did have a, you know, I felt somewhat of a personal connection to each of these characters that I researched, most of whom, I mean, it is a history. Most of the characters themselves that are long passed away.
Of course.
I approached each character trying to take them at their word and follow their story as sincere as sincerely as possible, right? And trying to uncover, you know, why they thought it was at the North Pole or why they thought it was in Ohio, and not so much to sort of make fun of that. You know, I think it is a little bit of a picaresque idea, but it's an idea that's very powerful and very potent and has stuck around through all of history and continues to today. So I certainly have respect for that as an idea.
We will talk much more about that, about the Garden of Eden and her book Paradise Lust, Searching for the Garden of Eden with Brooke Walensky-Lanford when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmaker's Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org. Taste of Judaism has everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. In three upbeat, fun, free, informative sessions, Taste of Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. You'll study with outstanding rabbis, including Two Jewish's Rabbi Sam Kohan. Learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. And have a great sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are offered at various times at three Tucson locations. At Temple Emmanuel in central Tucson, on the northwest side, and on the east side. All classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, Taste of Judaism is free. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 327-4501. More than 3,500 students have taken Taste of Judaism. Why not join them? Call 327-4501 and ask for Mila to register for Taste of Judaism, the most popular and effective introduction to Jewish learning and life. Call 327-4501 for your own Taste of Judaism.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So we were talking last week about the giant protest movement in Israel, really an economic protest movement, young people, chilonim, that is secular Jews, who don't feel like they have a piece of the pie anymore, even though the economy in Israel is vibrant, 5 to 6% growth rate, unemployment, maybe 5 or 6% also. America would kill to have those kinds of numbers. And Israelis are having this big protest in which nobody's getting killed, but people are clearly upset. So let's talk a little bit. You mentioned last week that young Israelis feel like they can't quite get into the system. They can't buy an apartment around Tel Aviv, but the high cost of living. What else is involved in this?
Well, we mentioned last week the different sectors that are not part of taking the burden, like the Haredim and
the ultra-Orthodox and to some degree the Arab society.
We mentioned prices of apartments, which are very significant.
What does it cost to live in? I mean, I'm not talking about the most spectacular place in Tel Aviv, but just a normal, what do they call it, 4 or 5 room apartment in Tel Aviv?
Well, you know, the prices varies, but for example, to buy a 4-bedroom apartment today, not far from Tel Aviv, like in Ra'anana, you would probably need at least $1 million.
And that's not a house, it's not a mansion, it's not even like a Central Park townhouse, it's just a regular old apartment, a nice apartment.
A nice apartment for 4 bedrooms.
For a family of 4, maybe.
Well, sometimes because of the prices, you need to make the kids share, and you might find families that have more than two kids that live in smaller apartments. Now, there are areas where you might be able to find lower price apartments. For instance, if you go to Kiryat Malachi, which is considered to be a very low income city.
It was a development town, essentially. Yeah.
There you might be able to find an apartment and around $200,000.
For an apartment. Right.
But in a neighborhood that is not considered to be
so good. So the good. Schools probably aren't as good. And it's not close particularly to where you would be working.
True. Especially, you know, if you look at the map, you'll say, well, it's only less than 20 miles away from Tel Aviv. It's really close. But when you drive your car with all the rush hour, it takes you at least 2 hours or 1.5 hours to get to Tel Aviv. So if you need to drive 3 hours a day just to get to work and back, that's an issue.
Now, Israel's density of population isn't quite Hong Kong, but it's like in the top 5 or 6 most densely populated countries in the world. And it's really more than that, because obviously the Negev isn't very heavily populated. So the central area is really dense.
Right. Most people are not aware that 70% of the land in Israel is desert. It's the Negev, which is more challenging, let's say, if you would like to build there a city and live there. And also, with all the political aspects, most people wouldn't choose to live at Judah and Sumerian, which are another, well, probably 20% of the country, around 20%. So all that is left is really a very narrow area, about 10 miles wide, probably not more than 50 or 60 miles long, which goes around Tel Aviv.
So a lot of these protests then are just about the practical needs of families to have a place to live and be able to work and have a normal life.
That is true. I will point out, and maybe we can talk about it next week, that there is also a more philosophical aspect of it, which is a difference between how Israelis view economical system and social justice and the way Americans would view it.
Absolutely. Let's talk about that next week. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with famed restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, the J Bar, and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, that is really just a wonderful restaurant you've built downtown. Tell us about it.
Well, we're really excited about it. We haven't even been open a year yet, and we've been named the best new restaurant in Tucson. The food is fantastic. It's a lot different than what we do at Janos and J Bar. It's really American food, but it's American food through the eyes of the latest round of immigrants to the country. So it's American food that's Asian and it's Latin American and it's African and it's from the Middle East. It's a wonderful, wonderful flavors opened up to us. And that bar is pretty great, too.
Fantastic. And all kinds of specialty drinks, too.
That's one of the things that we're really having a lot of fun with. You know, come in and we've got 20 or 30 specialty cocktails you've never had before. Everyone you're going to want to have again.
What's the phone number to call for reservations or where's the website?
623-7700, downtownkitchen.com.
Thanks, Janos. Can't wait to eat there with you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
September 11th, 2011 marks the 10th anniversary of the events that changed our country and our world in the most profound ways. In Tucson, we'll commemorate this day as both a memorial remembrance and an inspiration to help build our community, our country, and our world for good, for life, and for peace. Out of our diversity of background, creeds, and races, we embrace a deep unity that employs our collective gifts to remember 9/11, to be inspired, to strive for a better future for us all. Here on Too Jewish, in the coming weeks, we'll highlight the events associated with the 10th anniversary of 9/11 each week. There is a website dedicated to that purpose, Tucson911.org, or go to Tucson911.com. For more information on all these events, go to that website, Tucson911.org. Beginning September 1st, Pima College will be presenting a play called Elevator, about six people trapped in World Trade Center elevator on 9/11. Call 477-PLAY for more information or link through the website tucson911.org. And also on September 1st at the University of Arizona Student Union, Alan Burson, the Commissioner of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, will speak at 7 p.m. on Changes and Challenges, Border Security Post 9/11 at the U of A Student Union on the 1st. For more information on all 9/11 events in Southern Arizona, go to the website tucson911.org. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You usually report to us on the whole world of Jewish life, but university campus is another world, too, to a lot of people who don't spend much time there. What's the mood towards Israel on the university campus with Palestinian statehood going to be announced, supposedly, in a few weeks at the UN?
Well, to be perfectly honest, the campus has been pretty empty these past couple of months because it's been summer break. Students are just beginning to return. Class begins tomorrow, and I will have a better sense then. However, I think that, in general, most students are fairly apathetic about this issue. Jewish students either don't know or don't care. Most non-Jewish students certainly don't care and probably don't know. There may be a few foreign students from the Islamic world, particularly from certain countries within the Islamic world, who actually care one way or another. And if they care, they are likely to be pro-Palestinian statehood. And they are likely to blame Palestine's problems, or the problems of Palestinians, on the Jewish state rather than on the Saudis, where blame should be properly assigned.
You know, it's interesting because in addition to people who might be seen to have a real natural involvement or care, Jews caring about Israel and people from Arab countries, Islamic countries, maybe having hostility towards Israel. There's a whole, of course, political aspect to this in which the left wing, which used to be so supportive of Israel, is generally hostile to Israel now. The right wing, which is not as prominent on most campuses, tends to be very supportive of Israel. And some of the people that seem the most exercised about Israel and Palestine are not Jewish and have taken really strong positions. The latest phenomenon has been some people claiming to be Jewish, you know, disaffected young Jews who don't like Israel, and protesting Israel when they turn out not to be Jewish. Has that ever happened in history, to your knowledge?
No, but the point about the right-wing Christian groups, there is a fairly strong presence of those people on campus. Again, not over the past few months, but normally during the academic year, yes. And
I'll reframe my question. As we approach
right,
the coming
they
academic
care
year, Tom,
a great deal. And you remind me of a book lent to me by one of your congregants called The Finkler Question,
right,
which is about sort of left-wing anti-Zionism among Jewish academics, artists, professionals in England. And it's very well written and actually captures a certain mood, which I think was once true here, but is probably less true now, which is a kind of sense among left-wing liberal people, maybe even especially Jews, I was going to say including, but maybe even especially, that somehow Israel is guilty of something, because historically Jews have always been blamed for everything. So we've somehow internalized that process or that accusation and being defensive. And the group that the author makes fun of in the Finkler Question is called Ashamed Jews, and that describes them very, very well.
Well, I hope we don't have too many ashamed Jews floating around. We'll talk next week, Tom. Thanks.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Morty and Abe, who are not religious men, are walking their dogs by the temple on Saturday morning. Morty says, "Let's go in. I hear they have great chopped liver at Kiddush every Shabbos." Abe says, "They'll never let us go in with our dogs." Morty says, "Just follow my lead." And into the temple he goes. The shamus, the, you know, caretaker, stops him and says, "No dogs in the shul." And Morty answers, "It's my seeing eye dog." Shamus says, "Oi, okay, go on in." Abe follows him, and again the shamus says, "Hey, no dogs allowed in the shul." And Abe answers, "It's my seeing eye dog." And the shamus says, "This is your seeing eye dog? A chihuahua?" And Abe says, "Is that what they gave me?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, and a new definition of chutzpah, I would say. A special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. This week, we read the Torah portion of Re'eh, fourth Sedra in the book of Deuteronomy, which follows a sequence of marvelous Torah portions with yet another remarkable text. Re'eh includes one of the most radical statements in the entirety of Torah. If there will be among you a poor man, one of your brothers, within one of your gates in the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand from your needy brother. You shall certainly open your hand to him and give him enough for whatever he lacks, whatever he wants. This commandment is not simply to provide for the needs of the needy, not just alleviate their suffering, but to give them what they actually want: sustenance, security, a decent life. It is much more than we seek to provide in our society, in which the safety net seemingly has as many holes as net. It is a powerful, dramatic statement. Open your hand, give to the needy poor what they ought to have. This is part of a strong economic agenda in Deuteronomy. No one is supposed to accumulate great wealth or enormous power. No one must be left destitute either. Most importantly, our moral obligation is to see to it that none of our brothers and sisters is left without what they need in order to survive. This is a foundational lesson in the morality of giving. Give not only what someone needs in your opinion. Give her or him enough to live reasonably and with dignity. That is the true measure of tzedakah, of living justly, of righteousness. Judaism at its heart is pragmatic ethics. We're trained to make the world morally better by our actions. And so after exploring the Talmudic dictum that even those who receive charity need to give something to those with even less, our rabbis conclude that tzedakah is meant to be a percentage of your income, not a hard figure. And that the same percentage, whether 10% or 5% of gross income or some other number, must be given in good times and bad. It's true, when there is less income, there will be a smaller absolute amount donated, but the percentage, and thus the integrity of the individual's morality, must be preserved. So even in these crazy roller coaster times, open your hand and do so freely and generously when it's tough. At all times. When we come back on Too Jewish, author Brooke Walensky will explain just what the Garden of Eden has meant throughout history and today, and all about, well, lust. Hot stuff when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Our brothers,
Right here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, there is a college student named Gabriel Matthew Schiavone who has been leading dishonest protests against Israel and has claimed to be one of a growing number of young American Jews seeking to disassociate themselves from Israel. Okay, the problem is that he is actually not in any way Jewish. In various articles, this guy has claimed to be Jewish, though. It has now been conclusively documented that he is not now, nor has ever been, in any way Jewish, which goes a good long way to undermine any credibility he has. It doesn't faze him. He says he is a person of color, which allows him to speak on, well, never mind what he says. Why would somebody pretend to be Jewish who isn't? I mean, haven't Jews throughout history spent a great deal of time and money and plastic surgery effort pretending not to be Jewish? Well, in fact, this fool from the U of A isn't the only one to claim to be Jewish, so that his words and actions against Israel would have some extra credibility. Some of the passengers on the Mavi Marmara, the Turkish flotilla ship that Israel interdicted last year, were also pretend Jews, or at least that's what they told the media. What's going on here? Basically, it seems that in their efforts to discredit Israel, no amount of duplicity is too much, including people who are not Jews pretending to be Jews. And I'm not talking about the people that only show up twice a year on the High Holy Days. These are people who are really not Jewish pretending to be Jewish, a brand new historical phenomenon. We hope it is not long-lived. In other news, in a year in which the Conservative Movement's Seminary, Jewish Theological Seminary, ordained its first openly lesbian rabbi, things are also changing for women, even in the modern Orthodox world. First, an Orthodox woman rabbi, Sara Hurwitz, was ordained in Riverdale last year, and now Yeshiva University, the most prestigious Orthodox institution of higher learning in the world, is awarding a doctorate in Talmud to a woman for the very first time. The university's Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies will give a doctorate to 30-year-old Shana Strock Schick, a New Jersey native who is now living in Detroit. Schick successfully defended her dissertation on August 4th and will formally graduate in September. Orthodoxy has long emphasized the value of the study of Talmud, says Schick, but Talmud study, which in yeshivot is the central focus of the religious duty to learn Torah, is still rarely emphasized as a vital part of women's education. Maybe that's now changing. Ms. Schick holds a master's degree in Bible from Revel and a bachelor's in Judaic studies from YU's Stern College for Women. She plans to spend the next academic year in Israel doing postdoc studies at Bar Ilan. Mazel tov. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish Brooke Walensky-Lanford. She's the author of the new book, Paradise Lust, Searching for the Garden of Eden. She grew up in Maine, studied religion at Wesleyan. Good place to study religion, I should think, and as graduate of Columbia University's MFA program, has written widely on the web for the Huffington Post, Salon, Killing the Buddha, and others. And her new book is garnering tremendous attention. Brooke, tell us, what's the most powerful aspect of the Garden of Eden story for you?
Well, I think of it, I think it has a powerful sense of nostalgia and wanting to get back to a place of perfection or a place of peace or an original place. I think a lot of these characters that I write about it tend to look at it as sort of our original hometown, you know, the origin of everybody. And I think that's a sense that a lot of us can identify with. A lot of us have been an important element of the Garden of Eden is actually the exile from Eden. And I think the element of exile and nostalgia and longing for a perfect place is something that many of us can identify with.
You know, obviously originally, well, we don't know that, but it's in the Torah. It's one of the primal stories of Jewish tradition. And it's used sort of to convey a moral message, but it's an ambiguous moral message, isn't it?
I mean, I think so. The book focuses, I have to say, on the Jewish tradition. In my knowledge, and I would love to hear more from you about this, actually, does not tend to look at the Garden of Eden as a literal place that can be searched for on Earth, right? I mean, it has certainly a very deep symbolic interpretation, and the Tree of Life is very important in Jewish tradition. But those folks that I write about who really think that they know where it is, that runs a little bit counter to
They aren't Jews, basically.
Right, though.
You know, it's interesting because Gan Eden becomes for Jews, you know, then that's our heaven. And so it's kind of getting back to or getting to the garden. You can see the Song of Songs in the Bible as sort of a paradise found, you know, again, just as you parallel Milton with paradise lust, you know, the paradise found for us is getting back there, maybe in the afterlife. But the most of the people that you write about seem to have a strong religious motivation.
There's a wide array of religious backgrounds, but I would have to say most of them tend to be Protestant of various forms. And I think that there's, my theory on why that is has to do with Christ and their interpretation of with the redemption of Christ. In certain Christian traditions, he's sort of seen as a second Adam or the last Adam. You know, he's there to redeem original sin, right? And if we're redeemed through Christ, maybe there's an option. Maybe there's, you know, maybe there's like a little door opening in the Garden of Eden that we can try to get back into. And I think that's part of the motivation for a lot of these Eden seekers that I've found. But certainly there's a very long tradition of the Garden of Eden as not an earthly place, or as a paradise of the afterlife, a heaven, if you will. And that's, in a way, that's a sort of, and maybe even a more powerful way to look at it, because then, you know, it's not just any old earthly place that we can walk to on a map. It has its own special, somewhat mystical power.
You know, one of the figures that you ended up not including in the book, but you've spoken about, is General Charles Gordon. I think he died at Khartoum, a major British hero who thought that he found the Garden of Eden in the Seychelles in part because they had a tree that dropped fruit that looked like a woman's bottom. Can you tell us that story a little bit and why you decided not to include it in your book?
That's a great story, and I'm regretting that I did not include it in my book. I have to say the reason
There's always times for, you know, there's always chance for another edition, updated,
sure,
revised, and
you know, I get sort of, this is a curiosity in a lot of ways, and it's sort of a picaresque book, and it's sort of certainly meant to be taken as enjoyable. And I do get people saying, you know, really? Are that many people really looking for the Garden of Eden? And actually, back when General Gordon was drawing maps of his Garden of Eden, there were so many other people seeking at the same time in the 1880s that I just couldn't fit them all in the book. And that's actually why I had to leave out Charles Gordon, unfortunately. But his story, you know, what... As many of your listeners will know, there's a passage in the Bible that describes the geography of the Garden of Eden.
Right, the four rivers flowing out.
Yeah. So many of these seekers have actually come up with their own idea of what the four rivers are. Two of them are named the Tigris and Euphrates, and the other two are named Pishon and Gihon. And nobody really can place those two rivers on Earth anymore. So this has been an opportunity, an opening for these Eden seekers to go looking pretty much anywhere that could be the Pishon and the Gihon. General Gordon drew this amazing map, where the Seychelles are located off the east coast of Africa. So he drew these maps connecting the Indian Ocean through various riverways back to the Middle East, right? So it all goes back to the Tigris and Euphrates. And it's kind of an amazing geographical feat. But you know, he went to this island, which is actually where the newest royal couple, Kate and William, had their honeymoon on this island as well. So it's still known for its beauty and for this crazy palm tree that has an exotically shaped fruit, shall we say.
What was your favorite place? What seemed to you the most likely location, if indeed the Garden of Eden was ever historical?
Well, you know, this is a difficult question. I think that, you know, the Bible does mention the Tigris and Euphrates, and I think that there's a general scholarly agreement, and I'm not saying that this is a religious statement, but there's a general sense that those oldest stories in the book of Genesis have some ancestry in Babylonian mythology and legend, right? Epic of Gilgamesh and other stories that come out of southern Mesopotamia and the marshes of Iraq. And that's where we get a lot of flood stories. There's certainly some amazing echoes of the Noah's flood story in those myths. And I think that to the extent that the Garden of Eden was a place that was described by these older Babylonian stories, that it would have been in Iraq, likely near the head of the Persian Gulf, near where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers meet. That even the marshes themselves actually are they stand out in the middle of the desert as this lush place where it's fertile and there's a whole different species and ecosystems live there. So it's sort of, you can imagine it as a perfect place, as an oasis that would, you know, come down in myth and legend through these people of the desert, right? It's a watery, beautiful place in the midst of the desert, and I think that's about as close as I can piece it together, you know?
Seems likely to me, but it's somehow so much less exciting than a Garden of Eden with a tree of the fruit of knowledge of good and evil and, you know, such a spectacular story. You know, your writing reminds me a little bit of Tudor Parfitt in Search of the Lost Ark, or Paul Thoreau, sort of some of his travel writing, moving around the South Pacific looking for paradise. Who were your models, and did you have any literary heroes?
Well, that's a great question. I have lots of literary heroes, and I certainly love Thoreau's work. There's a writer called Tony Hurwitz.
Yeah, he wrote about the Civil War. He's also Jewish, of course. Has a great book about, was Confederates in the Attic?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and he has one following the explorations between Columbus and the Plymouth Rock called The Voyage Long and Strange.
Yeah, also a very good
really
book.
An inspiration. Right. Yeah, because I like what he does, and also I like the work of Sarah Vowell in terms of writing about history in hopefully with a really engaging and fun, you know, way. And both of those writers just kind of dive into the history and put themselves into it and try to like tell the story from the character's perspective with a little splash of, you know, humor for the rest of us. And I think that's important, you know? Storytelling is the best way to learn history, as far as I'm concerned.
So just how much lust would you say proportionally is in your book?
I really can't claim truth in advertising there. It is not a lusty book in the traditional sense.
Well, in the sense of a lust for adventure, let's say that.
Yes. And I think the more accurate term would probably be obsession. All of these characters are obsessed with the Garden of Eden in however they conceive it. And they're really working hard to convince people that their way is the right way. They draw these amazing maps. They write books. They give speeches. And they're still looking, you know, even to this day.
The book is called Paradise Lust, Searching for the Garden of Eden by Brooke Walensky Lanford. And you can find it at Barnes & Noble and online. And is there a website?
There is, paradiselustbook.com.
You know, and that's certainly the best web address you're going to type into your browser all day, I promise. ParadiseLust.com. Brooke, thanks for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thanks so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. as we interview Professor Asher Susser, Senior Fellow at the Moshe Dayan Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Tel Aviv University and the author of Israel, Jordan, and Palestine, The Challenges of Palestinian Statehood. And of course, listen to all our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website and friend us on Facebook. Everybody needs friends. Our playout this morning comes from Ofra Chaza, her early hit, Rachamim. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
name.